Welcome back, everyone, to episode 3 of the Shop Stool Podcast for season 6.
Socks.
I don't know about you guys, but I've had a very wild and busy couple of weeks.
Awesome.
Which we can get into. But yes, I apologize if everything is all over the place. We were just talking before we started the show about morning routines and kid drop-offs and how that's just... Like, you're trying to run a business while be a parent, and it is just the brain melt is real.
Yes.
Yes. We all Absolutely. Have bags under our eyes this morning.
I'm like half a man today, yeah. I'll be honest. Let's pull it together for the show. So we thought we'd start with that high chair story that I teased towards the end of last episode.
Yep. What's up?
And I don't even think I've told you guys about this. So about a year ago, I made a chair for a high chair for my boy just out of pine. And when we went to move to Tassie, I sold it to someone. That person contacted me a few months ago and said, "Hey, I really like the chair. We've got another kid. Could you make us another one?" So I said, "Yeah, of course. That's fine." We did some back and forth on the price, and it was a little bit too much for her. So she said, "You know, is there anything you can do to bring the price down?" I realized that. and as a side, I do want to get your opinions on this, but I had material left over from the reptile enclosure, so that's paid for. So I said, "Well, look, we can use that material." So that brought the cost down dramatically. Right. Instead of using pine, I'm now using Vic Ash. So it's also a better material. So I was able to upsell it to her as well and say, "You know, we've brought the price down and you're getting a better material." I made the high chair. I made it a slightly different design with a slightly different, thinner, more delicate style. In particular, the seats of it were a bit thinner.
Right.
Then with the pine. So I think they were down to about 12 mil. Now, to give you an idea of this high chair, there's two side pieces which bolt together and squeeze a seat and a footrest, which can be adjusted. It's quite a common design if you go.
Yeah, I think I've seen the design, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty common. And in the original one, I just copied it off that. I was essentially just following that. And then... handed it over. She loved it. Everything was great. And I get a phone call a week later. My mum has sat on it and it's broken the seat.
Well, no shit.
So it was amazing. My first thought went to, yeah, that's right. I've got liability insurance. I'm sorted. I checked with her and her mum was okay. So there was no issue. She wasn't angry. If anything, she was a bit shitty with the mum for sitting on the chair.
Right.
But I personally was a bit conflicted because on one hand, this chair in my mind was clearly not designed for adults. This is a 12 mil piece of material. It's clearly not designed for adults. But then on the other hand, I didn't mention that to her. And the previous chair that I'd sold her could have taken the weight of an adult because it was a bit more chunky.
What do you call the chair?
What do you mean?
What did you call it? What did you call it to the client?
A high chair?
Kids chair? Yeah. So, I mean, it's all in the name, right? It's not an adult chair.
This is the reason why there are warnings on hair dryers saying do not use in the bath.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. You just... It's definitely not your fault. 12 mil in solid timber, I would say, don't have the risk to break. Like 12 mil in ply would be a lot stronger.
Mm. Yeah.
But like along the grain, and 12 mil, like it is susceptible to that. But I mean, you're designing it for a child. You're not designing it for an adult. But you have to think about a child jumping on it. So then you're probably getting up to about a load force of an adult sitting on it.
Yeah. If you had 12 mil end grain on, it would probably be okay. It's less susceptible probably to split, but it depends how wide the chair is. But yeah, probably just a bit small. But still, Like, she shouldn't have been anywhere near it.
Yeah, so what does she want? So what's she asking you to do? Is she asking you to fix it or?
So that's, and I'm glad you guys gave your opinions first, because I wanted to hear what that was before I went through my fix. So I said to immediately bring it back and I'm going to fix it for you. Not even going to question it, partly because the fix was quite easy, because really, I mean, it's gluing it back together. And partly because I just wanted to I wanted to make sure that I was the good guy here.
Yeah.
I didn't want to add any pushback. Doesn't matter whose fault it is. Let me just fix this. She brought it back. I then got some extra material and made it thicker. So now there's less chance of it. And I did that all for free and gave it back to her. In that scenario, because admittedly this was a simple fix, should I still be, or would you guys still be charging for that?
My honest opinion is you set yourself up for a bit of a fall at the start when she's talking you down on price and you're saying you're trying to come up with a solution to meet her budget, which is cool, but you're taking the offcuts of another job, which you've said to yourself, this material's free, and the material's not free. You've bought it.
Mm.
So, like, I would be, if you were looking at that avenue, I would say, if you're trying to upsell her on the piece, you're saying, I can do it for the price of pine, but you're going to get Vic Ash. But the idea of going up in the material and going down in price has automatically put you at a disadvantage. Like, it's created a hierarchy in the thing where she's got you. A little bit. Like, that might sound harsh, but I think then when there's something goes wrong with the piece, she'll be way more likely to come back at you and say, you sort this. And I do appreciate the going above and beyond to fix problems. Like, I've done it before in the past and done it for free when it hasn't necessarily been the client's fault or my fault, and I've taken it on myself. If there's, like, I think you remember the island bench for the architect that I did, where I had to cut into the steel frame and stuff. Yeah.
Mm.
And I kind of found a price point where they were going to have to cover, I think it was about 60% of the repairs and the van hire or the truck hire to get the thing to and from the workshop again. But it was still me taking a lot of a hit on something that was not my fault. So I do appreciate that. And, like, I still have a good relationship with those clients. Who now, incidentally, they contacted me a few weeks ago and they're moving out of that flat into the house and they want to take the thing with them. And I'm like,
no way.
Oh, yeah, cool. Good luck. So, I do see what you're talking about. In terms of the making it cheaper at the start, I would have looked at ply as a base and just try to get a couple of sheets of plywood, dead easy, no glue up required, cut to size and fit it.
The plywood's an interesting one. Just to add this in, she started the conversation, I don't want ply.
Right.
Because in her mind, because it's her child and her child could chew this thing, she didn't want to use ply. I didn't feel the need to argue on that.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's fine.
They want what they want.
That's what she wants. Because I'd originally said to her, ply would be the way to go from a strength perspective.
Yep.
Well, just from you can buy one sheet of plywood and get everything out. You can probably make two seats in one sheet of plywood. But
is the idea of the chemicals in the glue for child ages?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I would say it's an interesting concept.
Yeah. But actually, companies are making eco-friendly water-based glue now, so you can buy plywood that's completely non-toxic. Yeah. It just costs more.
Yeah, it's a tricky one.
I would have. Yeah. My initial reaction was absolutely charge to fix it because you didn't do anything wrong. And also, just so they know that you don't just do stuff for free. You're not just the cool man who's just going to come and fix problems for them. Because I have had a couple of early clients who used me as a kind of, oh, while you're here, I've also got this doors jamming and can you put something...
I just need this split system hung on the wall. You know, you can do that, can you?
Like, You're a handyman. Eh? You've got the tools. You can do it right mm-hmm. while you're here because you're here. And it's like, it's not really my wheelhouse. I can't do that. So what I would have said is there's a minimum kind of service fee required. Like, it's going to take me at least an hour to do something to fix this up. So it's going to cost you at least, whatever, $50, just so they know that you don't just do shit for free. There's a bit of time there. You had to spend 10 minutes gluing it together, bit of a sand, bit of a...
It turned into at least an hour.
Right. Yeah, by laminating the extra.
And the thing, like, whatever.
So. Like Joey's saying, if you set off the relationship with that sort of hierarchy thing, say in a year's time when the kid has dropped porridge all over it and the thing needs refinished, she is most likely going to call you and go, hey, the finish on this isn't looking great. What can we do about that? And she, I would say the intention is for her to get that done for free.
Yep.
Yeah.
So. I actually had a client do a similar thing to me with this kind of a wall-hung low bookcase thing. And they had all this, they'd left a vase that was leaking on it. And they're trying to sell the house. And there's a big black mark where the water was under the vase. And they were like, oh, look, you know, can you, what is the product? Can you, maybe you should just come and do it if you've got a little bit left in the can or something. And I was just like, I just said, sorry, can't help, but here's a link to how to use oxalic acid. Here's a video. Go for your life. Because that's not
my... Or this is my hourly rate.
I didn't want to know about it because I was just like, I can't fix a black mark and an oak veneer top. It's not going to happen. Like,
oh, is it a veneer as well?
Yeah, yeah. If it was solid, I would say, yeah, just come and scrape it off until it's mostly clean. But like, this is a veneer. It's not going to happen. This might help. Oxalic acid will probably bleach it out a bit, but I don't know. So at some point, you've got to kind of say, look, this is now not a manufacturer's kind of quote unquote fault. It is a maintenance issue.
Yeah. And you've used the hair dryer in the bath. I can't help.
Cause I had, a while ago I made these, I don't know if you guys remember on my Instagram, I made these gigantic sliding doors, outside doors that kind of slid off to enclose about a deck area, so it was quite a nice little spot. It turns out that they always have them shut, so they never open. They might as well just have a full-on built-on screen. But anyway, I had the problems with one of the doors. I had to replace one of the panels. Some water had got in and it buckled, and I replaced the panel and had to go back a few times to paint that panel, and then the owner came out and was like, oh, you're just painting that panel. And I was like, yeah, this is the one that needed the work. All the other ones had bird shit, grime and shit from the storm blowing dirt and grime, and a little bit of green mold started growing on some of them. And he's like, oh, you're not going to paint all of them? And I was like, well, no, that's maintenance. It's been like 8 months since I did it. I'm fixing this one. It's going to look brand new. It's going to look a little bit different to the other ones. But, you know, if you want those clean, you know, the hose is there and there's a scrubbing brush. Like
you didn't say that.
I did because I was like, that's how you, if you want to clean it, soapy water, brush, hose. Like that's your job as a homeowner. You've got to maintain your house. And it's not my job to keep coming back every time you think it's dirty to put another coat of paint on it. And you have to nip that idea, behavior, you got to nip it in the bud to say this is not how it's going to work.
Because people will take the piss.
That's probably a good time to mention this client has been lovely.
I'm sure.
Oh, they're always lovely. Always the ones that push that little bit further are the nicest.
She offered to pay for the repair.
Mm-hmm.
She said, what do I owe you? I said nothing. So she's been totally cool from that perspective. In terms of the, you know, what went wrong with it, she assumed blame on her mum's behalf. So it, you know, I it was certainly no me fighting her. So just in case her or anyone I know that listens to this podcast, I'm absolutely not dragging her name, and she's been fantastic about it. But I can imagine that going forward, there might be one or two assholes that, that come along.
There will definitely be assholes.
Yeah. With the so, I posted this whole experience online just to get other people's opinion, and I had a number of different, a range of different opinions on what people think was the problem, who was at fault, etc. And someone did made a comment along the lines of, because you weren't explicit on the weight, you know, the weight rating, that puts you at, you can't assume.
No.
Because it's a kid's chair that it can't take an adult.
And what if there's a big kid?
Well, yeah, I tested with my daughter. She's not particularly big, but still, yeah, I would.
But, I would, you know, I agree. I kind of agree with that sentiment in that, you know, typically you might see something like that, even if it's from the cheapest whatever store you go to, it's probably at minimum got a little triangle sticker with like 12 kilos, little dumbbell or something like that's. And so that is a good idea maybe in future perhaps to, well, that's why they manufacture these things, but, you know, put a dumbbell on it and see if it breaks, and then say, okay, static load is breaking at 20 kilos. So, yeah, that's
but
it.
Not even that. Even if I just said to the client, this is made for kids, I am telling you, so we're on the same page.
I don't know.
Yeah, but the difference of a verbal thing versus something that's actually written,
I agree.
Is legally different. But then you have issues as well. Like, because we work with timber, and say you made 10 high chairs and you're doing that, maybe not 12 mil, but say it's a little bit thicker. Every piece of timber is going to respond differently to load, right? Yep. You might have a fracture point that you don't see inside the long grain joint of that.
Yep.
So it's one of the reasons why we try to over-engineer things.
Mm.
And especially at the start of everybody's woodworking journey, things look chunky. Like, things will look chunky for a few years. Like, you look at some of the best furniture makers in the world, the stuff that they were making year one, year two, are not pretty things. So it's something you learn through time as to how far you can push the limits. And definitely for items like a chair, the way you approach joinery and member sizing and things like that, it's a learned experience, I think.
Mm.
So it's all very well to say, you know, this high chair can take 15 kilos, but then this one might only take 10 kilos. So unless you're doing mass production or you're using something like plywood as a base, which has a bit more, it's a more engineered product that you can guarantee. Yeah, predictable. It's just it's a really tricky thing.
Yes.
Mm. Well, at the end of the day, it all worked out. The client was happy. It was a real, oh shit, I'm doing this for real moment. Damage control.
And like, I think in the end of the day, you did the right thing. They needed a working chair. You had to give them a new seat because no one else could do it. So you are, in a sense, when you are a single guy making stuff, you are pushed into that corner of no one else is going to do it. So, look, I've got to do it. So let's just get it done and move on. And that's really the best attitude.
All right, cool. Well, other than that, Brian, you are working towards the word has literally like evaporated from my brain.
Exhibition?
Exhibition, that's the
exhibition.
One.
Exhibition, yeah. So I've got the Ballarat Craft Lab coming up in a little over a week. So it opens Friday the 17th of May.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I've got
next Friday.
Next Friday. Next Friday's bump in, and then it opens to the public on Saturday. So, yeah, I've been preparing for that, and it's the first, like, I've been part of exhibitions with John Wardle post-COVID or during COVID, but I haven't actually done an exhibition of my own work.
Right.
So it's been a challenge, like, as we went through, like, with kids and stuff and trying to balance daily life with work, with setting up my temporary workshop, with planning my new workshop and sort of starting to get the engineering drawings for that, as to, like, preparing for this exhibition on top of it. But it's, I'm good. I'm feeling a good place with it. So I got all my marketing material done. So a whole load of, I was going to do business cards. I went back to A6 postcards,
cool,
just to get a bit more image space on them. And really good recommendation. I got my business cards printed through an American company called Moo. M-O-O.
Yes, I think I've used
like in
that.
2016. And I got nice ones, and they were kind of laminated with a core in them.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd spent 6 years in my workshop in Maramarong being cooked yeah, and then frozen.
Right.
And they delaminated. And I contacted the company about it in like 2020 or something. I said, listen, a few of these cards have started to delaminate. No questions asked. They're like, here's a code for the total value of the cards. Just put it towards whatever you want. And I was like, oh, amazing. And then during lockdown, of course, I didn't do it because I was doing nothing else. But it just sat there and expired. And I was like, shit, I should really see. I'll just chance my luck and see if they'll honor the code. I contacted them straight away. Here's the full value of the credit. Order something else. In terms of customer service, these guys are, I mean, I'd love to be using an Australian company for it,
mm-hmm,
but Jesus, yeah, these guys have just been incredible. And the print quality is really good. So the cards arrived this week. They allow you to do multiple backgrounds as well, which is a really cool thing. So I've just got one side of the card, which is my information, a bit about the business, contact details, and the other side, like, I think I went for 11 or 12 different product photos.
So, I did that. I think I used them, and I put like the same thing, and I had like, I don't know, 6 or 7 different cards in one yeah, batch, and it's just amazing yeah, that, and you
it's
just get like
doesn't it?
Potluck out of the box of cards, and it's so cool having different stuff.
Yeah, and then at an exhibition, people can flick through and find one that they like and take it away.
Yep.
Again, it's just that thing that I've always promoted, is to have some kind of physical reminder of yourself for people, whether it's a postcard, a business card, a folio, but just something that's not just digital or a photograph gets taken of your piece and then that's it, it disappears. Just to have something that they can take home.
How are you dealing with actually having something to showcase? Because I've got a couple of pieces of my work, but they're all, you know, they've been around the house and they're a bit dinged up and stuff, and I couldn't yeah, put them on display. Like, so what are you going to do?
It's called There's the Hose, Joey, with a little bit of soap.
I kind of, in my old workshop, I'd always kept a few stock pieces, and it was kind of helpful that I was in such a small house that they didn't end up in the house. They just ended up in the workshop with blankets on top of them.
Nice.
Yep. So I have probably 4 or 5 pieces. It's a small space, so I've had to, like, my wife was laughing at me because I was modeling it all up in CAD and like, because I've got all the model files of the pieces, so right, like I might as well drop it in and check clearances and how everything works in terms of height, because it's in one of the archways of the old mining exchange, so mm-hmm, it's a fairly tight space. And pretty linear as well. And I've got to be doing demonstrations in it. So trying to work out where I'll be standing and things like that. It was a really valuable experience for me in terms of modeling it all up. So I'll be taking 4 pieces. I've made some nice plinths for them out of pine, which I ripped out of a built-in wardrobe in the house the other week. Right. And it turned out to be the perfect amount. So the bases are on pine and then just with a bit of nice plywood on the top, pieces will sit there. But yeah, it's just that whole mindset of getting back into like really selling your work in person as opposed to just selling it online has been interesting. I've gone through, updated a lot of my website, changed a lot of the descriptions, taken off references to Melbourne, replaced them with Ballarat, which has been
cool.
Like, I wouldn't say I've been putting it off, but it's like, oh fuck, it finally feels real now.
I've actually done it.
Done a few logo and branding changes. The chisel has finally come off my logo after 12 years of my wife pressuring me to remove it.
Really?
It's just, it's gone.
I'm going to Instagram now.
Oh, what does check it? Instagram. I haven't done Instagram yet. Go to the website.
I'm going
to
get Lonnie onto you.
Just go to the website.
The exhibition, is it just you or is it other people?
No, I think there's 16, something like that.
Yeah, okay, right.
But yeah, I'm the only furniture maker.
Yeah, that's right. You mentioned all the other crafts that are there, yeah.
Yeah. And then on top of that, I've been asked to present at a thing called Pecha Kucha, which is like an architecture event, architecture and design thing. Did I mention this in the last podcast? I don't know. Sleep deprivation does weird things to my brain. But the go is, it's a, like a quick fire presentation. So you've got 20 slides and 20 seconds per slide to sort of tell your story or tell a bit about how you design things. So I'm in the process of doing that, and that's going to be the following Thursday night at the Rare Trade Center in Ballarat. So yeah. Thursday the 23rd. So yeah, that's going to be fun. There's a few other, there's an architect, there's Wooten, the bootmaker. There is Kate and Jack, the publishers from We Are Makers, are there, and they're covering the whole event, which is going to be pretty cool. Yeah. So
awesome.
Been nice to meet them after all these years of FaceTiming and stuff. So,
the that's going to be cool. Do we know, do you have any idea on numbers?
Not a clue. Expecting? Not a clue. They do tend to draw quite a big crowd. It's being co-hosted by UNESCO, which is like the UN sort of arts conservation thing.
Thing or something,
Heritage and arts, I think it is. So they are bringing a delegation from Paris to it. So I would assume that's going to draw other delegates from around Australia.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be quite good. And there's lots of different events associated with it as well. They do a thing called the Great Takeaway, which is like a big dining experience where it's chefs making local food, local produce. But you basically buy your seat and you take the setting home with you. So the crockery, the cutlery, everything's sort of locally made, and you take it all home, and that's being hosted in the space. So people that come to the dinner can come and walk around and see all your stuff in between it. So
that way they don't have to do the dishes.
Exactly, yeah. So I'm excited to see what it's going to be like. It falls on the same weekend as Melbourne Design Week. So whether that's going to help or hinder numbers, I'm not really sure. But yeah, it's all
go.
It's all go. And yeah, like I said, this new shed. I finished the design of it. I've kind of worked out where it's going to sit on the land. Now I just need to get through council and get my builder booked in to get it underway. So hopefully by springtime, we've got a new workshop.
And in terms of the business side of things, has that impacted your planning process or your council approval?
Well, I'm literally at the early stages of dealing with council, of doing like a fire plan, fire management plan and things like that with them. That's what they seem to be more. If I was in a more residential area, it probably would. But at the minute, because it's farm zone, it's hopefully going to be a bit more straightforward.
Oh, so you don't have to do instead of a residential approval, you're doing like commercial. It's not necessarily as...
Yeah, it's a lot different. So it doesn't go out to advertising unless it's within, I think, 100 metres of a neighbour with 50 metres of a road, of a main road and things like that. So I'm not triggering any of those things. So it's literally just getting council to sign it off rather than neighbours. But yeah, I've locked in 150 square metres is where I've kind of settled on, which is going to be good. So up from 120 in Maribyrnong. And it's a deeper plan as well. So I was like 5.6 meters or something wide in Maribyrnong, so quite long and skinny. It's going to be 18.75 or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Give it about 150. Yeah. Yeah, it's good size.
Why did you choose to go so rectangular and not square? Oh, I guess
you don't
use space,
so. You don't way really have the choice space. Because a lot of the shed kits are based on a predetermined width, either 7 or 8 meters.
Yeah.
I still like the idea of having a linear-ish space. So I may even subdivide the space. I don't know what you've done in yours, Joey, but I was thinking about having a machine room to one side, a roller door in the middle, and then having my benches on the other side and actually putting
a wall in?
Some kind, either a wall or like a half wall, and have some of the, you know, the butchers kind of
right
butcher's clear curtains things.
That's essentially what I've got. Like, I think my workshop is 12 meters wide. And
really wide.
And essentially, I've got a wall running down about 3.6 meters in, and that wall goes all the way down. And part of that walled off space is my office, and then most of the rest of it is my spray paint area.
Yep.
And then the other open area of the workshop is all the machines, but my machines are blocked off from my benches by a half wall. Yep. So it goes up to the ceiling, but it's only comes across the machine room by a couple, like 2.4 meters or something. And it's just enough that it gives, I really like the idea of internal walls because you get more places to put your benches. You can lean stuff against it, hang tools.
Hanging space, yeah.
And that's where I've got a heat pump in that area as well. So that's where I spend most of my time. And if it's cold or hot, I can actually feel that it's doing something. And that really seems to work quite well, having like essentially three different spaces.
Zones,
yeah, machining, bench work, and clean painting area.
Yeah. I wouldn't do as much painting as you, so I probably won't go sort of spray boothy thing. Mm. Don't know whether I'll go in office, but yeah, I would think probably a machinery room and then a hand tools and assembly sort of space.
What do you do currently? Like, I assume you mostly use some kind of oil for finishing your work.
Yeah, like a hard wax, Fitties, so, or Osmo or something.
What do you do when you... Do you often oil something and then have other work to go straight on with?
I usually oil at the end of the day.
Right, okay.
Or just save it up until I have multiple pieces.
Interesting.
Do them all. Okay. Like if I'm trying to get them, obviously during the cold, it's not ideal. So in Maribyrnong, like I would wait until 10, 11 o'clock in wintertime.
Right.
Oil a whole load of stuff up and then, you know, it's kind of cured by 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. That's not going to pick up any dust nibs and then do other stuff in the interim. But yeah, hard wax is obviously a lot better. Like the second you're starting working with poly, like the dust becomes a big problem. But I think I can get away without having a dedicated finishing room. But we'll see. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'll find a temporary booth or something or something that folds off a wall that I can I can extend out. But
I just have the room because as soon as something's ready, it's oiled, going in the room, and I shut the roller door, the barn door, and I'm just straight into work making dust, whatever I want, right next door. And I run fans. Osmo especially just loves having airflow, and the fans, just regular old rotating cooling fans. And that just gives enough airflow to really dry pretty much anything in 2 to 3 hours. So.
But yeah, I'll probably hit you up. I might draw some plans and see what you think in terms of layout, because it's been a long time since I've done a shop layout.
Yep.
I'm obviously not going to be bringing any machinery in the near future. Would love, I don't know. We'll see. May get a dedicated jointer if there's enough money left over.
A jointer. Very nice.
Yeah, man.
Change your life. A friend of mine here in Townsville keeps coming around to my house because, you know, to machine his work. And every time he comes around, he says, oh, you know, I need to get myself a better, because he's got a shitty little benchtop jointer,
which
flexes. And every time he comes around, he says, I need to get one. I keep saying, you need to get one. This is, in my opinion, if you are a woodworker, a jointer and thickness of, and in my opinion, a dedicated jointer is the way to go. You've got a combination.
I've got a combo, which I was always squeezed for space in the different workshops that I was in. So now it's at the point where I'm like, I could probably just set the combo up and just use it as a thicknesser. Because it's carbide cutters in it and stuff. So it's like, what would the resale value be on it? Would it be enough for me to then buy a dedicated thicknesser, or do I just use this as the thicknesser and then buy a jointer? Because the problem with the combo machine is always with the tables, like especially where there's heat changes. So here in Ballarat, of course, it's going to get pretty cold in winter and pretty hot in summer. So trying to keep all those tables coplanar and stuff and the resetting of it is just time, and time equals money.
Yeah.
So,
and I wonder in your area, because you're in Victoria and rural Victoria, I wonder what the secondhand market would be like to get yourself an old machine.
I had a brief look. I don't know whether there's more people that buy in Victoria, but stuff seems to go a lot quicker. Like a lot of the ones that stay on, is it Machines for You? Can't remember what the secondhand website is. A lot of them seem to be WA and Queensland. But yeah, we'll kind of cross that bridge when we come to it. I'll just get a layout done.
Yeah, get a workshop.
And press ahead with it. So the new workshop, the kind of temporary garage workshop, is finally set up, and I should probably show it on Instagram just as proof that I am still alive. And it's actually working really well. Like it's definitely not like efficient with the machinery layout, having to pull things out, but all my machinery is on wheels, so it can work. But the efficiency of the short distances to walk between things is actually pretty new to me, like something that I haven't had since my first workshop, you know, where you literally bench, tools, miter saw, table saw, like you're literally just pivoting around and every machine is there and there's still enough space that I can wheel stuff around and create assembly space.
That is the downside of us privileged folk with big workshops, that it sometimes is annoying when you're like, you're down on your knees at one end of the workshop trying to fit up something and you've got to walk 10 meters to the other end, lop something off with a drop saw, come back. It's just annoying if you do that 100 times.
Yeah.
I've taken my miter saw, the switch to rotate it. I've taken that to the kidneys too many times to ever feel bad about having a bigger workshop, because that's not fun.
Right, Robin, you wanted to talk about some pricing maybe?
Yeah. I had a couple of questions around quoting that I wanted to run by you guys. The first, and this sort of ties into the high chair topic, as well as the reptile enclosure. So anyone who follows me on socials will know that I've recently delivered this reptile enclosure. It was definitely a two-man, possibly even a three-man lift. So it was huge. Put on the back of my trailer, drove it across town. When I originally quoted for this, the delivery conversation never came up.
Right.
So the main question is, how detailed and what items do you guys add onto your quotes to make sure that everything is covered? Because this is obviously an example of something that I missed.
You go first, Joe.
If it's something, well, everything has to be delivered. So typically, almost, I'd say 99% of everything I make, I have to deliver it because I've got a van. And typically on my price, I say this thing is going to cost you $5,000 delivered in this area, because often I don't know exactly where someone lives until they accept the quote. And it's happened to me a couple of times. In fact, the job I'm working on, where I suddenly realized I don't know where this person lives, and I've included delivery because I say in the Auckland area, but actually this current client is in Wellington, so 9 hours drive away, and but they were happy to cover the cost of me to drive down and deliver it. I just said to them, oh, look, it's going to cost you like $1,200 for me to drive this there and back. And they were like, all right, so fine.
So it's not a line item. Delivery is not a line item.
No, I just say it's just included, because they don't need to know how much you've allowed. You could say delivery is $500, and they say okay, and you're like, fine, I just made like $400. If you want to do it that way. So I typically don't tell people how much is it allowed for, just say that it is going to be delivered.
Yeah, okay. But it's written into the quote.
Yeah, I just say after the price, it's like, the table's going to cost you $5,000 plus tax delivered in this general area. If it's outside the area, then we need to talk about other things.
Yeah. I'll generally ask them where they are as like a pretty early point in the conversation. And I would know a rough ballpark. Like in Australia, it doesn't seem to make that much difference in terms of couriers, if it is on the fringes of a city. So say you're delivering to like a rural town just outside of Brisbane, it's probably going to cost the same as Brisbane.
Right.
So I can kind of work out pretty quickly what a ballpark quote will be. So I will say to them once the conversation, they want a dining table. I'm like, right, what's your budget for the dining table? What size is it going to be? And they'll say, well, we've got 7-8 grand to spend. And it's going to be 3.2 meters. I'm like, right, 3.2 meters is too big for my van. So there's, you know, there's a courier or a truck hire. So do you want me to deliver it? This is going to be the cost. If you want a courier to deliver it, it's probably slightly cheaper. From my perspective, there's sometimes advantages of me delivering stuff versus a courier. And sometimes it can work out cheaper. Like that bed that I drove to Adelaide worked out far cheaper. And, you know, the client liked the idea of meeting the person who'd made it for them. So I would always be pretty upfront with them. In terms of something like that reptile enclosure, when it's a big piece, I'll always have a contingency factor in my quoting. So on every single piece, there will be 5% contingency, whether it's like a memory box or a coffee table or something like that. When it starts to get into big pieces, I would nearly go pretty close to 10% contingency. The idea that you might need to hire an extra pair of hands to help for the day, or just the unwieldiness of it. Like, is that a word? Unwieldiness.
Yep.
Unwieldiness.
It doesn't have wheels, everyone.
But the difference of trying to joint a piece of timber that's 3.5 meters long versus 1.8 meters long, like it's way harder to do the 3.5. takes you exponentially more time.
Yeah.
Tries. Yeah. And more risk of things going wrong. So I would factor those things into your quote.
So sorry. So that contingency is not to do with delivery. That's just to do with the entire project.
To do with the making of the piece, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But yeah, the delivery side of things, I would always give them a ballpark. And, you know, it's going to cost somewhere in the region of $400 to $600. So that at least they know that, like, you're not trying to rip them off, but that it could be anywhere within that range. I'm now, like, by moving regional and reducing my overheads to effectively just once I've built the shed, my overheads are my bills,
power, that's about it,
and power and stuff. So I am now going to offer free delivery on my pieces to metropolitan Melbourne to kind of offer that as a point of difference.
Yeah,
whereas in Melbourne I was having to factor in all those delivery costs, and then it will be a matter of me getting really organized with my time so that any drives to Melbourne are going down with furniture and coming back with timber or coming back with hardware and things like that.
Or so that it's not multiple
or go down with multiple pieces. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's just about getting really organized with things, but yeah, I would always, always charge for delivery unless say you've got a very, very large commission and you think that client is going to come back to you for more work. Mm-hmm. And it's something that doesn't involve hiring a truck, something that you can fit in your van and it's a short drive, then maybe think about free delivery that you're having.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, effectively, if you've got a van or some vehicle that can transport most kind of things you make, effectively, delivery is free.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't really cost you, unless you're driving hours and hours. If you've got to go across town and spend 45 minutes of your day dropping something off and coming back, you just got paid to make the piece, and an extra 45 minutes is really nothing.
And
so you can include in, like I used to include in maybe $50 gas money for me to get across town and back. Like that's about it, because they're still paying me for the piece. It's just part of the job.
And you just stick that in the quote, right? You would never say to them, it's going to cost you $50, because then you look like a tight arse.
Yeah, because that's how you say it's going to cost you this much delivered, because that includes everything. It's like an all-in-one package. And what I've learned is that clients just want to know what the total bloody cost is. They don't want to have to keep adding all these options together. They just want to say, how much is it going to cost me? That's it. Right. Let's go with you.
Yeah.
And so you give them, if you can make it as simple as possible and just give them an all-inclusive price, and they seem to like that best.
I suppose, I don't know whether have you done much work in the South Island of New Zealand, or everything has been North Island? Done stuff in Queenstown, or is that my imagination?
I feel like I've sent something down there, but I can't think of what it is, but not much.
I guess the only thing is, like, it depends if you want to do work all over Australia. Say you start getting inquiries in Broome. Like, we live in a country the size of a continent, like it's the size of Europe. So, I don't know. It depends on whether you're prepared to eat a bit of the cost of it yourself, or like Joey says, you can factor it into the quote and not hide it there, but massage the quote to absorb that delivery cost.
Mm. If it's a massive thing, like if you had to go and, like, I'm going to have to next week or whenever drive 8 hours each way to drop off a job, that's a different kettle of fish. That is telling the clients, look, this is the cost of the piece, and if you actually want me to hand deliver it, which in this case I have to because I have to assemble it, it's just going to cost you what it costs my labor to sit in a car for 16 hours or whatever.
3 days of,
I mean, work, that is what it costs you. And if you want the thing, then you say yes. And that's it. So,
I had, like, pre-COVID, I had a lot of clients that would come to the workshop to collect smaller pieces.
I was
going to
ask, coffee tables and things like that. Do you guys do that, or is that not something?
Sometimes,
Okay. Mm-hmm. You don't steer away from that for any reason?
No.
In fact, I invite clients typically early on. I'll say, if you want to drop by the workshop, come see what and how I'm making your thing. I'm not hiding anything. Come and have a look at it. I'm happy for that to happen. And typically that's what sometimes you'll get a price from a wholesaler and they'll say, I don't know, this piece of wood's going to cost you $200 X the workshop. And that means you've got to come and get it. The X means we're not doing anything. You just come and get it. It's going to cost you. And so that's what sometimes I'll say that to a client, like, it's going to cost you. If you want to come pick up this chessboard I made you, fine.
Mm. Yeah, where it's delivery free. For that seems less real, especially if they're in town. A lot of my works come from in town, so I'd feel a bit odd delivering it to the person when
they could just
almost feels like I'm invading their privacy for no reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's whether you want to see the piece in the final spot as well. Mm. Like, it's always I like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you might have to remember your clients. This might be the first time they've ever commissioned a piece of furniture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, before I became a furniture maker, I'd never commissioned a piece of furniture.
Yeah.
So they might like the experience of coming into a workshop and seeing your tools and seeing the space where it was made in, or like Joey's saying, coming in halfway through. And
that's a massive selling point. Now that I'm set up with a nice workshop and I've got an office with pictures on the wall and pieces in my office, like, I can almost see the moment where clients relax and like they've made the decision that they're going to use me because they can just see it's legit. It's nice and clean. I've organized the workshop's organized. I've got 3D models ready for them to look at. Like, everything's just here and they feel comfortable about the idea of spending, giving some stranger a couple of grand, 10 grand, you know?
Yeah.
So I just spent 3 days on site installing a job that has been kicking around in a storage container for months and months. So I did a large kitchen and scullery, a laundry, some French doors, internal dividing doors between a lounge and a kitchen, and a vanity, installed all those things. And these jobs has been sitting around for a long time. I think the kitchen was probably at least 4 months sitting in the container waiting for the builders to do their thing. And I had I really didn't even know how it went together by the time I got there, and there was just all these boxes and I'm like, how the hell did this go together? And I found one carcass unit, and on the back I had written this whole big long scrawl, this long note about what I had to do. This unit goes on the wall first at this height from the wall, at this distance from the corner, and then install unit number 3, and then come back and install the corner molding, and then do this. And I just had it all laid out because when I had put it together in the workshop and then taken it apart to store it, I was like, I'm never going to remember this. I've got to write myself a note in the order of operations that it has to be in. And the kitchen just went together in, you know, 5 hours. I had my dad helping me, who's like 74 now. And we were able to put this kitchen together so quick, just because I had all these notes and every carcass was labeled with where it's meant to go and how far away from the wall it's meant to be. And it just went together, piece of piss. And
it's a great tip.
And yeah, I hadn't really done such extensive notes to myself before, but it really saved the day. So, tip to anybody, if you're going to have a delay in your job being installed, like if it's some kind of built-in unit, or even if it's just a complex thing and you need to know which piece goes where first, you just write big long notes on the back of it or on a piece of paper, stick it to it, and it just saves the day when you're not fighting or trying to find a measurement where you knew it in the workshop but now you don't know it. It's just written on the unit. It's great.
It's like Guy Ritchie. It's like the Christopher Nolan film, Memento, right?
Right.
He's got all the tattoos.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, yeah, yes. You do forget stuff. And, like, even if it's not an install job like that and it's trying to remake a piece that you might have made 3, 5, 7 years ago or something like that,
yeah,
to have one note about how you did a particularly difficult thing could save you hours.
Because I've had that where it's one thing to have a jig if you've got like, say, a chair, and someone comes to you after 6 months and says, "Oh, can you make me a chair?" And you pull out your jig and you're like, "What is this even for?"
Like, how do I use this?
I know it's for the chair, but like, so my jigs have got notes all over them. Like, this side goes onto the fence, and the fence is set to this measurement, and then blah blah blah. And
step one, step two,
Yeah,
that's a great shout.
Just having an order of operations for all those kind of repetitive things that you don't do often, it just saves the day.
Yeah, cool. That's a great bit of value to add to the episode before we head off.
We're going to do your last question. You're going to leave us on that cliffhanger.
Oh, okay. Well, this, as I said, it's a really really quick one. With deposits. Do you guys charge a deposit, which I think you probably will, even if the client provides the material?
Yeah.
Yes.
And how much? What percentage would you?
50%.
Half of whatever it is. Yep.
Even 50, when the client
I do 50% on everything, unless it's a massive, say it's a job that I know will take me 2 to 3 months. Then I'd be prepared to split it into maybe 3 installments or something like that, just in terms of aiding cash flow. But yeah, I'd always take a 50% deposit.
Here's the rub, Robin, because what could happen, and I'm dealing with this right now, so it's fresh in my mind. I have a client who wants me to do some things on a job coming up, big flash fancy house. And I said, right, let me know what it is and we'll start working out a ballpark price. Oh, price doesn't matter on this job. We just want you to do the work. And we'll have you in August to do it. And I'm like, okay, give me an idea of the scope of the work. I have some idea, but I need to know kind of what monetary value this job might be, because I'm going to book you in. I'm going to pencil you in for 2 weeks in August to do this work. Say it's 2 weeks. And then if you flip-flop on me in August and say, oh, actually, we're not getting you to do the work now, I just booked out 2 weeks that I can't suddenly just fill in my calendar. So I need you to commit to giving me some money as a placeholder. Even if you're not providing me materials, and even if I don't know the whole scope of the job, you need to pay for me to book in my time in the calendar, and that's my money. If you decide then that you don't want me to do it in August, well, I've got your money, and that's a cost to you.
You've been paid something, yeah.
I'm not giving that money back, because that's what a deposit is.
I've got a friend of mine, so it's more than just a client. He's a good acquaintance who wants an 8-seater dining table top made out of timber that's been in his family for 1,000 years. He's dropped the timber off with me I've quoted him the price for the work, but I've said, don't worry about... Well, I actually haven't said that specifically, but I was going to say, don't worry about the deposit because...
No, you need cash flow too. You can't wait until the end until... And then, you know, 6 months later, then you get paid. It's like, no, you need some money up front as some cash flow because it's all labor, right?
But this is a... It's under $1,000.
Take the money. I mean, that's a business. That's what it is. You don't go to electronics store and take the TV for free. They're going to set up some kind of payment system. Like, they want money down or all of it up front, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you can't it's not how any other businesses work. I would never commit to a job and have a 100% final payment. It's just asking for trouble. And even more so with friends. Even more so with friends, I'm like, business, hardcore professional business. There's no like leniency, because that's when shit can just go sideways with people you're on a friendly terms with, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. All right. I might amend the quote.
Yeah. All right.
It's a funny thing. Like, yeah, sometimes I feel like it's, you know, if I don't know you, yes, give me the money. But if I know you, then and this is something that I'll need to grow. This will be part of my growth. Mm-hmm. I feel bad saying, give me money. Cause that's not a normal thing, I think, for an average person, unless you're a business owner.
Yeah, I guess so. It's just one of those things. You've got to kind of have your own set of policies, even if you don't write them down. It's just, my policy is I don't do anything and this is money in the bank. I don't buy materials and this is money in the bank, because I'm not going to be liable for someone else kicking tires.
Yeah, you're not a charity.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. All right. Good show, everyone.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks again to everyone for the donations and things that we've received on the show and for all the positive reviews.
Yes.
I had a random look on the podcast charts and I think we were the 6th highest podcast in Finland for
definitely where we're plugging
DIY
it.
DIY and arts. Are you so serious? Thank you very much to all our Finnish listeners.
Yeah, yeah. Fins.
I might come up with a different chart rating every week.
Okay, different country.
Yeah. There's some bizarre ones. We do quite well in Mexico as well.
I'm interested to see what we are in Greece. Give me Greece for next week.
I'll try to find out Greece for you, Joe.
Okay, good one.
But yeah, cheers to everyone for listening.
Okay, thanks. See ya.
Bye. See you later, guys. Bye.
Bye.